Es gab nur dieses eine Krankenhaus.
There was only this one hospital, and it was completely overcrowded. There were many women who gave birth on the floor because there were only 5 delivery beds for 100 people. They were only allowed to use a bed at the last moment, basically when the child was already being born. And many ended up giving birth in the hospital corridor because there was no other way, because there was just no space. And then, on top of that, there was this uncertainty about what would become of this child. What country would it live in? And we still don't know what will happen to the people in Gaza.
Pregnant and children are particularly vulnerable. In Sudan, there's 1.2 million pregnant or lactating women at this point. 1.2, 80% of hospitals have been affected in the conflict. And violence is preventing aid workers to access a lot of these areas.
Women, of course, continue to get pregnant and be pregnant during conflicts and wars, but that is often not or forgotten, or that people are, like, when you talk about that, people can be a bit surprised. Oh, yes, of course they are, but I didn't think about it. But this is the fact. And they are protected under international law, and they need to be, and that need to be protected.
In the next 20 minutes, we'll talk about reproductive violence. A photo from Ukraine that went around the world in 2023 illustrates the realities of reproductive violence. It shows a heavily pregnant, injured woman. She is being carried on a stretcher out of the bombed maternity hospital in Mariupol, holding her pregnant belly. She and her child cannot be saved. They died a few hours after the photo was taken.
We see how women's wombs and bodies become part of the battlefield.
For this podcast, I spoke with Anika Flensborg from the Swedish women's rights organization Kina Till Kina, with the Jordanian women's rights activist Danya Garaibay, and with Anya Betzoit, who shares her experiences as a midwife with Doctors Without Borders during various war and crisis missions. You are listening to the second episode of our series, Feminism and War. This series will, among other things, deal with the escalation of violence and the war in the so-called Middle East. Also in this episode, we will talk about what it means to give birth in times of war, in Gaza and elsewhere. In this podcast series, we examine war and peace from a feminist perspective, focusing on the experiences of victims. We recognize that discussing the complexities of current wars can be emotional and controversial for various reasons, and that some statements may offend personal or political sensibilities. However, one thing is clear: we must address these violations of human and reproductive rights. By doing so, we can contribute to changing these unbearable situations. The suffering of one person in war does not diminish the suffering of another affected by the same conflict. The insights shared here provide snapshots of a complex reality at a particular time, specifically September and October 2024. In our second episode about sexualized violence and in our third episode about feminist solidarity, we discuss in more detail the challenge of reporting on the suffering on both sides in this war. In the fourth episode, we discuss various forms of cross-border feminist interventions for sustainable peace. What does this mean for solidarity within the feminist movement? Even providing help has become complicated, as noted by Anika Flensborg from the women's rights organization Kina Till Kina.
It is so sensitive, and it's so easy to be seen as taking one side or the other side. But from our perspective, we take the side of the victims and stand up for human rights.
Our voices, our choices. Der geschlechterpolitische Podcast der Heinrich Böll Stiftung.
So in the hospital, everything was missing. I don't even know where to start, and it's getting less and less. So starting with staple foods, water, all kinds of things, sanitary items, everything was missing. Sometimes donations arrived, and then we could distribute those. But you also had to be careful. How do you allocate all of that? And then you had to see and decide who needed it most urgently.
Anya Betzoit worked as a midwife for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza in February 2024 at the Al-Emirati Hospital in Rafah.
We don't go there and say, here we are. But of course we ask, what do you need? And they said, we can still manage the delivery somehow, but what we don't have at all is a postnatal ward, because we weren't designed to handle 100 deliveries a day. That meant that they had to send the women home relatively quickly after delivery. So with a normal delivery, they had to leave the hospital with their child just 10 minutes later, without anyone having examined the child or the mother. In the beginning, even after cesarean sections, they sent the patients home after just 4 hours, which is far too dangerous. And in this case, home always meant a tent or under a tarp. And in February, it was really cold. Doctors Without Borders set up a postnatal ward. So we ended up with 26 beds. But of course, that's still not enough.
The healthcare system in Gaza has been largely destroyed due to months of airstrikes and ground offensives by the Israeli military. There is only one hospital that still has a maternity ward.
Approximately 180 deliveries are expected each day in Gaza. We had around 100, which means that 80 deliveries were being delivered somewhere else. Of course, we can't reach all of them. In these circumstances, you don't want to have a child at all. No water, no sewage, no toilets. I mean, the water, these few liters you receive, have to be enough for everything, from drinking to eating, cooking to washing clothes and washing yourself.
9 out of 10 people in Gaza have been forced to flee their homes and have been on the run for months. Anya Betzoit says that very few women receive regular medical care during pregnancy. The women typically only came to the hospital when they went into labor, usually on foot or donkey carts. The hospital was overcrowded, and usually the women want to leave immediately, for fear of bombings. During her time in Gaza, Anya Betzoit tries to keep the women in the postnatal ward for at least a few hours after giving birth. It is particularly important to her to support the women with breastfeeding.
That was not always the case in Gaza before. Some women breastfed, but some didn't want to breastfeed or wanted to breastfeed a little and then give a little formula. And we really had to explain to them that they just have to breastfeed, that breastfeeding is their only chance of getting this child through. Because there was maybe a little milk powder, but it was really expensive, because it was only available on the black market. They really had to understand that this was their only chance. There are also hygienic issues, because milk powder means you need a bottle, you need water, which means we need clean drinking water to mix the milk. But of course, it is very difficult for the women to produce milk when they themselves don't have enough to eat and drink.
The hygienic conditions are not only a huge problem for women giving birth, says Dania Garaibe, and many are not only burdened by the fear of infections.
The loss of dignity is a story that not many people talk about. You know, it's part of sexual health to be able to have access to sanitary pads, for instance. A lot of women are telling us that they're using tent scraps and plastic to use as sanitary pads. There's an increase in vaginal infections and genital infections due to the lack of unclean water. We know that women in particular are very sensitive due to the lack of cleanliness, for instance. There's also the lack of dignity of not being able to wash yourself at all for months.
Gaza is under siege and nothing can get in either.
There is something very special and unprecedented in Gaza is the inability for humanitarian aid to reach the people. So even in Sudan, we're able to operate field hospitals in certain areas. We're able to go. Port Sudan is still open, but in Gaza, you cannot get in. There's only one way to get in. So that is very unique. I've worked in so many contexts.
Dania Garaibe works for CARE International, an organization that provides aid in various war and crisis zones around the world. She is the head of the Global Unit for Gender Equality and Inclusion. She lives in Amman, the capital of Jordan.
There's another thing that I think is also can be considered a reproductive health violence is the inability to access basic equipment and basic medicine and basic tools for the field hospitals to perform safe deliveries and safe reproductive services. I know that there's a priority for food because Gaza was on the brink of famine, which also affects reproductive health because pregnant women are in need of increased caloric intake and lactating women as well.
Women are forced to deliver under very inhumane and extremely dangerous conditions without any support or healthcare. So we see this as a form of obstetric violence, that what's going on in Gaza now, and that of course the violence needs to be stopped. There needs to be a ceasefire and humanitarian access to be allowed in, and mobile clinics with maternity health care system to be provided to access the women across across Gaza.
What exactly does the term reproductive violence mean?
We defined reproductive violence is targeting your reproductive autonomy, reproductive health. It attacks the reproductive organs. It's like forced abortion, forced sterilization, forced pregnancy, or also the intentional destruction of maternal health care. So it's really targeting the reproduction of a person and its health, either intentionally, or it's seen as something that soldiers, for instance, can, it's like a bonus for them if they come and they loot and they rape and they attack like women and their, or men for that matter as well, their reproductive organs, or the that is seen as a collateral damage.
Anika Flensborg is head of the Policy and Advocacy Department at Kvinna till Kvinna. The Swedish women's organization supports women and women's organizations in war and crisis zones. It was founded in 1993 by committed women when reports of mass rape during the Yugoslav wars reached Sweden.
In Bosnia, there were war rape camps where Bosnian women were held and raped and raped and raped again until they were pregnant and held capture there until for 9 months until their babies were born, and they had, they said, Serbian soldiers. So it was really intentional, both to carry new soldiers for the enemy, but also, of course, to destroy and demoralize and dehumanize the enemy. So that was really intentional. And I can't imagine almost any more invasive like form of violence.
Reproductive violence is a devastating weapon. It's effective, and it not only traumatizes individual victims, but also disrupts families and entire communities. In countries like Yemen and Sudan, women are frequently shunned by their families after being detained by enemy troops.
In Sudan, we heard a lot of cases where women came back from having been detained and raped. They were shunned by their own communities, and many of them, the community would not accept them again. So that this incentivized women and girls to speak up about these issues. If they come back pregnant, their children are unwanted. So the woman is left alone to raise the child in a war environment without any support.
Women who experience rape and forced pregnancy are left not only with trauma and physical injuries, but also with the challenge of raising their children without essential support networks and resources. Some of these children may become child soldiers, perpetuating a cycle of violence. Anika Flensborg explains that this cycle hinders reconciliation and prolongs conflicts. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, it took 30 years for the children conceived through war rape to be legally recognized. This acknowledgement only came in 2022, after years of silence surrounding their experiences and those of their mothers.
It's about women's bodies and the power of women's bodies, and that's always controversial, and that's always, and reproductive violence is at the heart of this. I mean, as we said before, like the womb and body become part of the war a battlefield because of motherhood and the link to the nation and the view that that women should produce soldiers and therefore being either pressured to produce soldiers or attacked not to produce soldiers or produce soldiers for the enemy. or like attacked not to be able to have children. So it's very linked to motherhood and the sense of as the motherhood of the nation.
This is also evident in Ukraine, according to Anika Flensborg. Kinna Til Kinna is also active there and supports local women's organizations.
We've seen it in Ukraine, but also in other conflicts, of course. So it's not unique for Ukraine, but that their women often feel a reproductive pressure from their own group because they should produce soldiers. There have been reports about sexual violence by the Russian soldiers as well. And as I said, also torture in prisons targeting reproductive organs.
Another conflict causing immense suffering for the civilian population is occurring in Sudan. A brutal civil war has been ongoing here since 2023, stemming from a power struggle between the Sudanese armed forces and the Rapid Support Forces.
In Sudan, that we're seeing is related to sexual and reproductive health, is unwanted pregnancies due to rape and gang rape and sexual slavery. Both the Rapid Armed Forces and the Sudanese Armed Forces, the Rapid Armed Services and Sudanese Armed Forces are both accused and of documented cases of sexual violence that include sexual slavery and gang rape and true horrific violations of girls as young as 9 years old.
80% of the medical infrastructure has been destroyed, and 77% of deliveries take place without professional assistance. Relief supplies are rarely allowed into the country, and it is often too dangerous for aid organizations to operate. Additionally, the incidence of forced and child marriages is on the rise.
I don't blame the families. Sometimes early marriages of girls is a form of a coping mechanism. You know, if a father has a friend in the, for instance, Sudanese armed forces, they know that they have a little bit more power, so they say, here, take my daughter with you, marry her.
The number of child and forced marriages is also increasing in the civil war in Yemen. Midwife Anya Besolt worked at a hospital for high-risk pregnancies established by Doctors Without Borders in Yemen.
In Yemen, the problem we faced was that we had a lot of child marriages and also a lot of teenage pregnancies. Many young women were married at around 12 years old and became pregnant shortly after, often by the age of 13 or 14, despite their bodies not being ready for pregnancy. So it was really quite bad to see, especially how some men were quick to say, well, okay, if she has a cesarean section now, she can't have a child for 2 years, so I'll simply find another woman. Those were some of the other problems we had, and we also had to work with my Yemeni midwife colleagues, who did a lot of educational work there. I found it truly heroic how they spoke to the men about these matters.
All these examples show that reproductive violence can take many different forms. But the issue persists. Even though there are international agreements designed to protect women's reproductive rights, such as the 1979 UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW for short.
Women are provided with their sexual and reproductive rights. CEDAW has Article 16, which guarantees women's equal rights in deciding freely and responsibly on the number and spacing of their children, and to have access to the information, education, and means to enable them to exercise their rights. So Article 16 in CEDAW very clearly says and protects reproductive rights. There's also articles in CEDAW that protect women from sexual violence, which is separate from reproductive, separate but related. But again, there's a sexual article 1 to 3 talk about it prohibits rape and other acts of sexual violence and gender-based violence against women and discrimination as part of the CEDAW agreement. So the CEDAW agreement is one of the most umbrella agreements that has been ratified by several countries in the world.
Nearly all countries have signed the Women's Rights Convention, including Israel, Russia, and non-UN member states like Palestine. Only a handful of nations have not signed, including Sudan, Iran, the Vatican, and Somalia. So international law does exist, and it protects the reproductive rights of women. As a result, warring parties in conflict situations also have a duty to provide special protection for pregnant women and those giving birth.
So that's also something related to the legal status of the provision of reproductive health services. So absolutely, when there's a humanitarian crisis and there's a breakdown in the healthcare services, protecting healthcare providers, ensuring the sustainable and accessible healthcare services to all people, especially specific and that address the specific needs of women, is very key. So there's an entire infrastructure that needs to be there, an entire system that needs to be there. So that it can be there easily, but it's being prevented by conflicting parties to become available for people. And when that happens, people are not held accountable for having prevented it. And that's why it's going to keep on happening and happening.
The impunity of war perpetrators is one of the central issues. Swedish women's rights activist Annika Flensborg emphasizes that reproductive violence have to be prosecuted consistently and perpetrators must be held accountable. So far, unfortunately, many offenders escape prosecution. However, there's a legal framework for holding them accountable, the 1998 Rome Statute, the legal basis of the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
It's in the Rome Statute. They recognize reproductive violence as a crime. But to have an effect, perpetrators need to be, they need to investigate these kind of crimes as well, and perpetrators held to account, which also helps to the work against stigma, because stigma is one huge obstacle to address this violence.
Stigma and silence protect perpetrators. Dominic Ongwen, a commander in the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, was the first person to be convicted of a war crime and crimes against humanity for forced pregnancy. That was 25 years after the Rome Statute came into force, only in 2021. But to this day, criminal prosecution for reproductive violence is the exception. This was the first episode of our series on feminism and war. In the upcoming episodes, we will explore topics such as sexualized violence, feminist solidarity, and peace building. How can we overcome the fragmentation within feminist movements? You can listen to this and all other podcasts of the Heinrich Böll Foundation in the podcast app of your choice. We would love to hear your thoughts, so feel free to reach out to us at podcast@böll.de. This episode was produced by Vanessa Löwel. Thank you for listening.